Hi, everybody. My name is Chad. I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be here tonight. I have a three-hour talk, so we'll take intermission in about an hour and a half. And then we'll get started on the second half. I actually had somebody ask me to do one of these once, and they said, I said, well, how long do I go? And they said, an hour. And they said, can you go that long? And I said, only an hour? I get to talk about myself for an hour? I could go for hours, and I do. My sobriety date is November the 12th, 1988. My home group is the Graceland Group. We meet on Wednesday nights at 7 o'clock in Linwood, Washington. We're about 20 minutes north of Seattle. We're right across the street from the Walmart and the Martha Lake Community Center. And we're an hour meeting, no child care, no BS. And we believe that we fulfill the fifth tradition by we read out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and share about our experience with that. And if you don't have experience on what was read, you're probably going to talk anyway, but we like it if you're not. And I get voted out on that one in group conscience usually. My sponsor is Alvin S., and he has a sponsor, J.S., and so on and so forth. And I have to start my talk by telling you that it is a privilege to be here, and I understand that it's a privilege to be here. Dr. Silkworth, in the doctor's opinion, he talked about that Bill requested the privilege of being allowed to come into the hospital and share his experience. And that caught my attention one day, and when I was reflecting on that and thought, you know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought it was my right to be able to talk here, and because I had a lot to say. And what I found is that it's really a privilege, and it's an honor, and what the group conscience, I'm assuming, has laid upon whoever chooses the person to be here is that I'm not going to come here and fill all your newcomers with a bunch of BS, because that's what I would think at my home group. So hopefully I'm not going to talk about my inner child tonight, and I'll try not to get into any, you know, rational thinking or therapy motives. These things always take on a life of their own. I got asked to speak at a conference, and I approached Don Pritz, and I said, Don, what do I do? And I was waiting for him to give me the, you know, make sure you wear a tie, and make sure you do this, make sure you do that, and da 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 da. And he just said, well, just go give a talk. You know, they obviously think you have something to say, so go say it. And I was waiting for some big, like, you know, thing. And he realized that that really wasn't, like, you know, answering my question. And he told me that, you know, my job here is to talk to one of you. You know, that's what I'm here to do. And I spend this hour to figure out which one of you it is, and then I talk to you. And so that's what I'm going to do, hopefully. And if I get done before an hour, then we'll go home early. My story is pathetic. It's totally pathetic. I took my first drink, a Southern Comfort, when I was in third grade, and I fell in love. And I will tell you that if Southern Comfort would do for me today what it did for me then, I'd drink it right now. You know, I would. Because it was great. You know, the promises came true. The nine-step promises came true. I knew a new freedom and a new happiness. Right? I didn't regret the past, nor did I want to shut the door on it. I comprehended the word serenity. Right? I mean, don't you? You know? And I continued to chase that thing for a while. And I never got it again, ever. You know, my experience with alcohol is that when I took a drink of alcohol, I could, you know, that feeling as it's going down, and then it hits your stomach, and that glow and that warmth. And for me, it like makes my hair stand up, and my hands just feel alive, and I just feel, you know, 4 feet taller than I already am. You know, I feel alive when I take a drink of alcohol. And then I take another drink, and then it's off and running. And I don't have any say over when it's going to stop or when I can start again. And when I don't have any alcohol, I do crazy things. Drugs are a part of my story, a very small part of my story. But when I can't get alcohol, I smoke a bottle of oregano. That's what I do. Okay? If you're new here tonight, I'm going to tell you that all you'll get is a headache. Okay? So nothing happens. It's a lie. Okay? When I was in early sobriety, we had heard that if you ate raw nutmeg, you would be high like on an acid trip for 4 days. So me and a friend of mine, we were in new sobriety, and we freaked out. You know, we panicked. And so we went to his house, and we grabbed all the nutmeg out of the house and flushed it down the toilet and went back to the NA meeting that we'd been going to, and they laughed just like you guys did. And I've never been back to an NA meeting since, right? It was like, those guys in Narcotics Anonymous do not know what they're talking about. And because they laughed at me, you know? And I first heard about Alcoholics Anonymous on Halloween in 1983. My stepdad was returning home for the umpteenth time. And he had this deal. He'd get drunk, and then he'd beat the hell out of me and my mom. And I can remember, I was sitting here remembering being so terrified in the morning when I'd wake up and I'd hear them rustling around. And I don't know what it's like for girls, but for guys, when we wake up in the morning, we need to make a beeline for the bathroom right away. And as a little kid, I can remember being so afraid to get out of my room and go into the bathroom because I didn't know what mood he was going to be in. And so I would open a window and pee out the window. I had to, right? I mean, I couldn't go out there. And so on Halloween 1983, he came home and sat down at the kitchen table. And the last time he had been there, he was removed by the police. And he said, you know, I remember the piece of paper today. He wrote AA down. And he said, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous now, and it's going to put our family back together. And unfortunately, that didn't happen. 6 months later, I was shipped to live with my dad in South Dakota, and my mom went into hiding until she could finally get divorced from him and freed, and he moved on to somebody else. And so when I grew up in alcohol, you know, and had to come to AA, I was not coming here. There was no way, because you people were horrible people, and you didn't fix my deal. You didn't fix my family. So I wasn't coming here, you know? And I like to talk about that because I think that we get a little excited about our recovery and think that everyone is going to be as equally as excited as we are. And unfortunately, they're not. And I think sometimes we do a little bit of damage to Alcoholics Anonymous when we go out there and you know, start to talk about how great recovery is, and then it doesn't work out. Because I wasn't coming here because of that. And by the grace of God, I did come here, you know. I don't like to spend a lot of time on my drinking because my recovery is really where my experience is and what's happened to me. You guys all have your experience with drinking. You guys all understand. You put some in, you can't control amounts. You do absurd, tragic things when drinking. You break relationships, destroy families, and then you get up in the morning and go, okay, I'm never doing that again. And then you do it again. You know, I can remember drinking. The lie and the insidious insanity for me is I remember going and drinking one night with a buddy of mine, and I went home. I went to his house, and you know, I was young, and I threw up all over his bathroom. And I'm not totally clear on this, but I think when you drink beer and you throw it up, it still smells like beer, right? I'm pretty sure, right? It smells like beer. And so his mom was very concerned and was like, "Are you okay?" And I'm like, "Oh yeah, I just ate something, you know. I had food poisoning, you know," and I remember going home, and, you know, I learned at a very young age that to lie, you have to believe it. That's the key. You have to believe the lie. It never goes over if you don't believe the lie. So I believed the lie, and I went home, and my mom, you know, it's 3 a.m, and here I come stumbling in, and she's like, "What's going on?" And I said, "Food poisoning. I ate something." You know, and I went to bed that night, and the room spun, and I woke up the next morning, and I was like, "Wow, I don't know what it was I ate last night to get that sick." but I had so much fun drinking that I'm going to do it again. Right? That's my experience. So hopefully that's your guys' experience too, and I'm in the right place. So what happened for me is I have no idea. I was struck sober on a day I had no plans of getting sober. And I think that's the best way. You know, in my opinion, I look back, I think I had a lot more drinking left in me. But for whatever reason, I was struck sober and I was brought to, tried to be brought to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it didn't work out. I wasn't coming here. I already told you guys that, right? I'm not coming here. And these guys that knew me, they kind of started dragging me around to different places. Not AA meetings, but they started dragging me around to different places. And they started taking me to different things. And they started showing me some different ways of being of service. And they tried to get me involved in some religious groups and some different things. And there was a small stint in Amway that I did. Hey, you know what? I'm going to tell you something about Amway. Amway is, don't laugh, because Amway is a lot like Alcoholics Anonymous, right? It's not funny. They have meetings. They have sponsors, right? They have tapes, right? They have all that stuff, right? They go left on the money deal, right? That's the whole, you know, the motivation thing on the money deal. But I did a deal in Amway. You know, I was going to do Amway. I was going to become a millionaire, and then it didn't matter if I drank, you know? It didn't, because that's what I was going to do, you know? My idea, and when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I have to paint the picture for you. I had long, blonde, bleach blonde hair. It was kind of feathered like Vince Neil used to have in the 80s. And I wore tight blue jeans that were ripped and shredded up, and white Nike high tops. And I was a wreck. I was a total mess, you know? And I didn't fit in. You know, I didn't fit in anywhere. And I hadn't fit in anywhere for a long, long time. And so, for me, I got sober young. And I like to see a lot of young people here. That's great. And when I got sober, my good friend Brendan, who sent me out here, he was sober on the east side. And he was stark raving mad. And I was sober on the west side in Seattle, and I was stark raving mad. And thank God we didn't run into each other until we'd been through some steps. Because I did absurd, tragic things in sobriety, you know? I did some horrible, horrible things. And I fought coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I finally found this buddy. This guy just kind of appeared out of the blue, you know? Divine intervention. And he showed up, and his name was Jason. And he was just out of court, or just out of jail. And he had to go to meetings, and I had to go to meetings. And so he took me to my first meeting, and I had been sober for a while. And so on the way out of the meeting, on the way home, he asked me to be a sponsor, and I agreed. That's funny. That is funny. I was sober going to my first meeting. He'd been going to meetings for years and asked me to be a sponsor, and I agreed. Because I had a real good understanding of what the hell was going on in AA, right? So I start sponsoring him, right? And he's like, well, what do I do? And I don't know. We'll get to that, you know. Let's just hang out. But me and Jason ran all around Alcoholics Anonymous in the 80s, and we had these young dance clubs. We could go and chase crazy girls and, you know, and that whole deal. And it was sickness upon sickness, layers of sickness, you know, in those places. You know, I'd walk in, I'd be all puffed up, you know, because I got in for free, because I knew the doorman, and here I am at the sober club, and I'm, you know, I'm this cool guy with the long hair and the ripped up jeans, and, you know, I'm going to be a rock star, and you know, it just didn't work out, you know, because I lacked dedication. I lacked dedication, right? I just wanted to go from, like, nobody to rock star. I don't like the, like, learning how to play your instrument. Or, like, I don't like that stuff at all. Okay, your hands hurt. I don't want any of that. So I just wanted to go instantly to, like, you know, rock stardom, and that didn't work out. So then what are you going to do, right? And I'm running around AA, and I got this buddy of mine, and I got to tell you, you got to have a friend like Jason in new sobriety. You got to. Got to find a friend, man. And I'm going to tell you, there's nights, you know, they say, you know, buddies ain't going to keep you sober, and that's true. Not for long-term sobriety, they're not. But I'm going to tell you, there are nights that Jason kept me sober. And there's nights I know I kept that guy sober. And there's nights I didn't keep him sober. And I know that. But me and him ran around in Alcoholics Anonymous just crazier than you can be for years, not working steps. I got my first sponsor in that time because I knew that there was something wrong and I needed something. And I got this guy to be my sponsor, and he had me meet him at this restaurant. And I'm looking at the menu, and I realize it's a vegetarian restaurant. So immediately, I fired the guy, right? Because I'm not having a vegetarian sponsor. You know, here I am dying of alcoholism. My insides are laying on my outsides, right? And I'm nuts. I mean, I'm totally insane. And here I am judging this guy who's willing to help me because he doesn't eat meat. And I don't even know that he didn't eat meat. It may have just happened that we meet at a vegetarian restaurant, but I judge the guy and out the door I go. And so I lived in Alcoholics Anonymous for that way for a long time. And 5 years ago, Jason signed a record deal with Columbia Records. And a week later, he laid down and put a plastic bag over his head and his headphones on, and he died. He killed himself. He had the dream, but he didn't have the happiness inside. And he never could get this thing. And that guy struggled in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for years. And for some reason, I stayed sober. And I tried to drag that guy to meetings and hook him up with the right sponsor and do all that stuff. And it just reminds me the seriousness of this deal. You know? The sad truth for me is that if I go back out, I may not die. Like, that's the easier, softer way. I'm going to live in my own misery and pain. And so, for me, I was really getting this whole sobriety deal, and so I decided that what would be a really good thing for me to do is to become a counselor. So I started to become a counselor, and I do say, with no judgment or harm mentioned to anyone else, but that I am a recovering drug and alcohol counselor. And I say that because I sucked as a drug and alcohol counselor. I was the world's worst drug and alcohol. My favorite part was paperwork. Right? I didn't give a shit about you or your day. I just wanted to make sure I had all the T's crossed and the I's dotted, and my files were perfect. Right? Group therapy, I hate it. My entire group relapsed on 420, right? On April 20th. The entire group comes back. Even the guy that didn't smoke pot came back and said, "I smoked pot." The entire group. And they're like, "What do you do?" I'm like, "What do I do with that?" You know, and I know that I'm not a failure for their deal, right? But it's like, I suck as being a counselor. I'm just not good at it. And it's really bad when you got to make amends to your clients, right? To the patients, right? You got to make amends to them because you're such an idiot, you know? And so, I won't go into the details of all that craziness, but so, I actually heard at an Amway convention once that if you have to be specific for what you want when you pray, right? You know what? We went to the Billy Graham thing and we're saved on the kingdom floor, Billy Graham deal. Me and Jason, we were looking for anything, any way out. We just didn't want to have to do the steps, man. You know, we just didn't want it. This AA thing was weird, you know? And so, So I got real specific one night, and I was in a relationship, and I'm sure there's some of you in this room tonight in this relationship. The relationship, it goes like this. I hate you, but when you leave, I hate that worse, so I'm going to run after you and beg you to come back. And then she comes back, and I remember distinctively, right, when I finally got to inventory, I'm writing inventory, and I'd look up, and I'd just like, I hate you. Like, I'm not even writing inventory about you right now, but I just hate you. Can you leave? I would wake up in the morning and look at her and go, how can I get rid of her? Right? And it's weird because I'm like a suicidal, homicidal guy. You know, like I'd prefer your death over mine, but I really, really just want to check out. You know? And I'd sit at stop signs, stoplights, you know, and watch the cars come. This is serious. And watch the cars come and just wait. You know, I just want to hit the gas and whoops, and it's over, right? But I didn't really want to die. I just wanted to be in the hospital so you all would come and visit me. You know, I really wanted that. And so, so here I am, you know, and I got specific and I got quiet and I asked God, I said, I need a sponsor. And I'm going to tell you, this man walked into my life the very next day. I was somewhere I shouldn't have been, and he was somewhere he shouldn't have been. And I left that place, and I knew that man was my sponsor. He'd just gotten back from Breckenridge from the very first Fellowship of the Spirit conference. And he was telling me about this guy named Don Pritz. And he was telling me about the voices in my head and that they'd go away. And he told me that he didn't think about drinking. He didn't think about not drinking. And that was the key to me, because I thought about drinking and I thought about not drinking every day. Every day. And so, he was kind of weird. He was kind of a little offbeat. And my big fear about getting a sponsor was that I knew I had some stuff in inventory that wasn't okay. You know, like there's some stuff I had done that I wasn't real proud of and didn't really want to talk about. But I knew this guy had done way worse. So I was in, right? I was golden, right? Because I could tell him about the stuff that I had done. And I knew he was going to come back with some bigger and better stuff, you know? And so we started through the book, and he talked to me about... one of the things he learned at that conference was that when someone asks, you can't say no. And he showed me in the book where that comes from. It comes in one of the forewords where they talk about the rush of 800 frantic inquiries rushing in, and each one of them was painstakingly answered. You know, Bill and his assistant wrote hand letters to those people. So he showed me in the book where it talks about that I have to do this if I'm asked. And so we started going through the book. Now I'm a drug and alcohol counselor, right? You'd think I'd have the first step down. No clue. No clue. Read the doctor's opinion. Whoa. Phenomenon of what? Right? And being a young person, I struggled with that. And I'll talk briefly about that. I struggled with it because I didn't have the experience of driving home from work, stopping by the bar. I'm just going to have one, and 4 days later end up at home. I did have the experience of not wanting to drink and drinking anyway. I was the classic forgetter, right? See, when you're getting sober at 13, there's a problem, okay? Just clue you in. There's a problem. At 13, you're trying to get sober and not successfully doing it, probably a problem, okay? So here I am unsuccessfully trying to stay sober at 13, and relapse and then doing the whole thing. When I got here, it's funny, people talked about relapse. I'm like, I never relapsed. And then I started getting into the first step, and it's like, you know, what was 13 to 15? You know, it was all just drinking. I'd forget. I'd get drunk. 3 months later, I'd be like, oh, yeah, didn't I? Wasn't I stopping this? Or somebody would say, I thought you quit drinking. I'd be like, no, you know. And I was crazy. And I'd drink almond extract and all that stuff, you know. And sniff glue. I was a big glue sniffer. And I was into huffing before it was even cool, you know. And I didn't even know. And so I get into the big book, and I get into all this, and I start putting all this against my experience, and the book starts to add up, you know? The book starts to go, oh, and I go, oh, I've had that experience. I know what that's like, to take a drink. And then the drink take me, and I don't have any say over where I'm going to end up or what's going to happen. And, you know, I could tell you 100 stories about that, you know? And ended up drunk when I didn't want to be drunk. Ended up getting drunk and not doing what I wanted to do. Damaging relationships. You know? So then we get to the second step. And my sponsor says to me, you know, you need to come to believe in this power greater than yourself. And I'm like, yeah, you know, the doorknob. And he's like, no, we're not dealing with doorknobs. Right? The problem with the doorknob is you can turn the doorknob. We're going to find something that can turn you. Right? And I was like, oh, yeah, I had this deal, Billy Graham, you know, that whole thing. And so I was able to start with this experience of just being open to this power greater than myself. And so we got into that. And the one thing I'm grateful for my sponsor that I had at the time is that he didn't waste time with me. He didn't take his time taking me through the steps. I got through at a pretty rapid pace. And what ended up happening for me as a result of that is that he saw I was dying. And I knew, looking back now, that there was no way I was going to get through inventory. There was no way I was going to get through it. And so When we got into the second step, he kind of got me through that pretty quick. But he would do this thing with me where I would call him and I would be like, oh, she said, and then it would usually end up with me going, I don't think I'm alcoholic, you know, because that's my deal. That's my way out. I don't think I'm drunk. I'm going to leave. And he goes, he'd just go, then go drink and hang up on me. Great. Thanks, buddy. What a sponsor you are. You know, I'm so afraid to do that today because I'm afraid the guy will go drink and die and then I'm responsible, right? Because it's always about me. It's always about me, you know? Which reminds me, I was taught when I do these things that, you know, the most dangerous place in the room for me is where I'm standing right now. And I'm clear on that. Because my ego gets a hold of some stuff, and all of a sudden, next thing I know, I'm a rock star in AA, because that's what I want to be, right? So I got to be a rock star in AA, right? And the deal is I'm a drunk. And I'm no further or closer to the next drink than any of you. And so we get ready to do the third step, and he tells me this thing about three frogs on a log. You guys heard that one? Three frogs on a log. One makes a decision to jump in. How many are left? You know, you say two, and your sponsor looks at you like, yeah, you're an idiot. It's three. He only made a decision. He didn't actually jump. So he's telling me this weird stuff like, this is the most important decision you're ever going to make. But then again, it's only a decision. Oh, okay, great. Well, then why are we going to do it? So I go over to his house, and I got no clue, man. My sponsor said, don't read ahead. I didn't read ahead. I got no clue what's coming. I get there, and the blinds are drawn. And he's got some sage burning. And I'd worked in the Native American community, so I understood about sage and all that. I'm like, oh, cool, we're going to do the third step. We're going to incorporate some other stuff here. That's great. So he sends me outside to do this little meditation. I come back in, and he had this big, blue, puffy chair, Lazy Boy. And you never got to sit in the Lazy Boy. You always had to sit on the couch. He got to sit in the Lazy Boy. So I come back in, I go to sit on the couch. He goes, oh, no, you get the Lazy Boy today. And I'm like, wow, cool, get the Lazy Boy. So I sit in the Lazy Boy. And he tells me to recline it. And then this like Native American flute music kind of comes over. And he puts a blanket on me. And I swear to God, I'm like, this is that deal I hear about. That 13th step, like these pedophiles in AA. These predators. And this is the deal. They get you in, they convince you of this stuff, and then whammo, when you're like in it, they're like, oh, you know? And then this babbling brook happens in like another room. It was like this orchestrated deal, and he's taking me through this guided meditation, and I'm just like, oh God, this is so weird. This is just weird. You know, and I wasn't quite sure about his orientation. I mean, he had a girlfriend, but I was like, are you really? Are you sure? And so we get done with the third step, and then he has me get down on the knee on his knees next to him, and we hold hands, and whoa, right? Like, page 15 of the John Wayne Handbook says you never hold hands with men, ever. And that was my experience, and I'm like, yeah, okay, God, yeah. And I sit down and I'm like, whew, that was good. Now I'm out of here, you know? And he looks at me and he throws a notebook at me and he says, start writing. I'm like, what are you talking about? He says, the book says next. We launched on vigorous action. Next. That means now. Start writing. And I won't bore you with the details, but I had 286 names. He limited me to three names. Per person, or three resentments per person. You guys do the math. It's a lot of resentments. I had a 200-page notebook full of resentments. People, places, and things. And his favorite was I had a resentment against Custer. All right? Guy lived 200 years before I was born, but I was pissed at him. And I was mad because of what he did to the Indians. And my sponsor, he left for like 20 minutes, and he went, the funny thing is the Indians killed him. Like, what are you pissed about? And you're not even Indian, so why do you care? You know, and I'm like, oh, no, that's horrible. And so anyway, I was resentful at everybody, right? And he said a lot of things to me. He was mean to me, you know. And he called me some really bad names, but they were appropriate. They really were. And he really hammered me on some things. And one of the things that he hammered me on was my grandmother. I was a taker in that relationship, along with all of them, really. I realized that most of the relationships I had, especially the relationships I had with girlfriends, that I backed you into a corner where your only option was to gnaw your own arm off or jump out a window. And you chose jump out the window. That's what I did to you. I'd be upset and in the meeting crying because she left me. But what I found through inventory is I gave her no other option. The sane option was get the hell away from this maniac. Really, that's what it was. And so my grandmother, I read the name and the da-da-da-da all the way down. And then I got to the end of it, and I went, oh, man, oops, I read the wrong third and fourth column on that one. And he went, oh, that's great, that's great. And I was like, what do you mean? And he goes, well, let's take a look at something. Read me the next name. And I read the next name. He pulls his inventory out that he had written, you know, a couple years earlier, opens it up and reads me second, third, and fourth column, verbatim what I got on paper. And I'm thinking, wow, how did he do that? Is he a magician? What's the deal? And what I realized is that you come into my life and I have an idea and a belief system around how you're supposed to treat me. You treat me any different than that and you go into the first column. I got a resentment against you. And I spend the fourth column trying to prove to you that I'm right and you're wrong. And I can do that for 286 names and several others after that. I sponsor a couple guys that come up with like 30 name resentments, and I'm like, man, I could come up with 30 names over lunch. Like, I'm resentful. I'm a resentful person, you know. I can do prayer meditation. I can do 10, 11 all day long, all night long, and I'm still going to have inventory to write. You know, I got to write inventory once a year. It's just what I got to do. And it's the only thing that works for me. So we go on, and he tells me I'm going to make amends to my grandmother, and I'll tell this story really fast. And my amends to my grandmother was I had to call her every Friday and tell her I love her. Simple, right? Not for me. I called her the first time, talked to her for a few minutes. I had to listen to all her crap, you know, her ailments and right? And then I got off the phone. And I called him up and I said, I can't do it. And he said, good, go drink and die. Hung up on me. So I'm like, okay. So I call my grandmother and I go, and she answers and I just talk to her, right? So now I have called her in the span of 10 minutes more than I've called her in the last 3 years, right? Something's up. So I say to her, I say, Grandma, she says, yeah, hi. And I go, hi, love you. And she goes, okay, bye, and hangs up on me, right? And I'm like, this isn't working out, you know? So every Friday I call her, I listen to her stuff. Okay, I love you, Grandma, bye. And I go to my sponsor after like 6 months of this. I'm like, when is this over? And he goes, you'll know when it's over. You'll know when you're done. So one day I'm at work. And I call her up, my Friday call, da-da-da-da, listen to the whole deal, da-da-da. And while I'm on the phone with her, they page me and they go, you know, Chad, you have a call line for 4 or whatever. And I go, oh, Grandma, I got to go. Talk to you later. And she said, I love you. And it was the first time she'd said it first. And I knew it was done. The amends was done. Not the living amends. I still got to show up. I still got to do that, right? But see, I'm so cool and so macho that I can't even make amends to my grandmother by just simply telling her I love her. The woman has given me 2 cars in her lifetime, just given them to me. She's given me more material things than I could imagine. And I would go there to take. I wouldn't go vacuum grandma's because grandma can't run a vacuum because she's too damn old to vacuum her house. I'd go there to get the pool cue or the camera or the whatever it was that I had my eye on that I wanted. And that's in sobriety. That's using and sober. I'm a taker. And so the other one that I did that day, that day we looked at my inventory. There was a couple of amends. My sponsor looked at me and said, I don't know how we're going to do this. I had no idea. So put them in the back of your deal. We'll get to them when we get to them. And they sat in the back of my, we do, where I come from, we do 3x5 cards. I don't know if you guys do that here. Put your name in the upper left corner, plus or minus in the upper right-hand corner, which I was over compliant, so I put pluses in all of them, right? Which is a total lie, because if there was a plus in all of them, I'd be done with them, right? And I'm not, so. So one night, years go by, and I have this amends in the back of my deal, and it's like, it's one of those ones, it's like, I got no idea. No idea. 6 months sober, I'm out screwing around with some friends. Buddy of mine's on the hood of my car, he falls off. He's in a coma for 2 months, nearly dies. And I was arrested, really feeling the gifts of sobriety at that point. And I had an experience through that. I had a spiritual awakening, and I really believe that's why I stayed sober, because it wasn't because of steps or AA. And so how do you make amends for that? This guy can't walk, can barely talk, doesn't have fine motor skills. How do you make amends for that? I had no clue. Right? If it was left to me, I probably still would not have done that amends. And I'm walking into this restaurant one night after being at my home group, and his mom walks out of the restaurant, and I actually hold the door open for her. And I look at her, and my head says, "Get in the restaurant and sit down." And my mouth went, "Hi, Jackie, it's Chad. Do you remember me?" Like, how could she forget? She instantly burst into tears, and she grabbed a hold of me, and she said, "Oh, my God, I thought you were dead. I thought something had, what had happened with you and Rick had killed you." And I just said, you know, I'm taught to do formal amends, but I'm taught that, you know, really the amends is about cleaning it up, however I need to do that. And all I could utter at that time was, "What do I got to do? What do I got to do?" And she said, "Come see Rick." And I said, "Okay, well." So I made plans to go see him, and my sponsorship tells me you take him out to dinner and you buy him dinner. If he can't afford dinner, get him coffee. Take him where they want to go. He wanted to go to Hooters. Not my choice, his, right? We go where he wants to go, right? I'm going to tell you, it is really hard to make an amends in a Hooters, okay? So I'm in Hooters. God, please be with me. Please, you know, take me to my next amends. Give me the power to complete it. You know, please remove your fear. Tell me what you did. And then, you know, Hooters girl, hi. You know, I'm like, whoa. Wasn't happening. So I waited till we left Hooters. And I said to him, you know, "Here's the deal, man. I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. And as a result of my recovery, I have to clean it up." And he looked at me, he said the most amazing thing to me. He said, "The past is the past. You and I will start here." Wow. Right? Whew. That's not it, though. That's not the end of it. Driving him home that night, and we're just about there, and he says, "Oh, man, I meant to ask you to stop and buy me a pack of smokes and a Dr. Pepper or a Coke or whatever." And I said, in my head, I'm going, "Ah, oh," because I'm selfish, right? I'm like, "Are you kidding me?" Right? The shitty thing is the guy can't walk. And I'm like pissed about this, you know? And I'm like, "Okay, God, okay. I'm clear on what the deal is here." I'm like, "Okay, I'll drop you off. I'll run down the store. I'll be back." And I go and I come back and his mom's car's there. And I'm like, "Oh, shit. How long is this going to take? You know, now I got to talk to her." Right? See, I'm totally selfish and self-absorbed, right? I'm narcissistic, hugely. And so I walk in the door, give him his stuff, and she comes up to me, and she grabs a hold of me, and she just says to me, "Thank you so much for what you're doing to try and make it right. You have no idea what it means. And I am so sorry for how my family treated you." I would have missed that. Right? How amazing. The level of forgiveness and love that this family just gave me. That when it was in the midst of it all, I'd show up to the hospital, because we were friends, you know, it wasn't anything intentional. I'd show up at the hospital and they'd run me out and call me a murderer. And she made it right then. It was amazing. And him and I hung out a few more times, and I don't know why. I know he still, you know, drinks and does some other things. And for whatever reason, him and I weren't able to continue. And he just quit calling me back, and I've left messages, and I just leave it alone. You know, because I know that I did what I did, and who knows where we'll meet again, you know? And so I went on through the steps, and I've had the opportunity to sponsor some men, and I've gotten crazy with sponsoring guys. And because that's a whole nother level of selfishness for me, right? It's really a great deal, you know? You got your harem with you, your posse, and they sponsor a bunch of guys, you know? And pretty soon, you're like the grand poobah in AA in your group, and and you can't have an off day because the grand poobah doesn't have an off day, right? So then pretty soon you show up to your home group and you're lying about what's going on in your life and the whole deal, and then you're dating somebody you shouldn't date again and that whole thing, right? My experience. So, see, us people from Seattle, we got to have like this stuff coming constantly. It's coffee. But, I had an experience where I hurt my back really bad. I had to have surgery and the whole deal. And after surgery, I started showing up at this group, and this woman kept talking to me. And as it turned out, her and I became really good friends. And I know that Kenny D was here last weekend and did a retreat or a workshop thing for some of you guys, and he talked a little bit about Darlene. And I see the people back home get tired of hearing the stories, but you guys are a fresh audience. So, and my friend Brendan, I called him when I was with his twin Pete today, and I said, "Yeah, there's another one in Seattle. If you ever get asked to do one of these things, do it because it's really weird. It's like Bizarro AA. You remember like Super Friends where they had the Bizarro Superman? He was kind of like, and then like Seinfeld, they did it where they had like the." So it's like, it's weird. Like you come here and I'm like, I've never seen a lot of you, but I'm like, oh, that's that one guy at my home group. And that's that guy at that other group. It's like Bizarro. Well, Pete is Brendan's twin. So, this is the Bizarro Brendan, the Utah version. And I'm glad this is being recorded. I will send a copy to Brendan so he can hear that I said that. But I talked to Brendan today and Brendan said, "Hey, you know what today is." And said, yeah, and we talked. And so my friend Darlene and I just became instant friends. And my sponsor knew, I got a new sponsor about 10 years sober. And he said to me, it was really funny because he's like, "Where are you at with your amends?" I'm like, "I'm not doing them." He said, "Okay, well, come over. Let's talk about amends." Next thing I know, I'm working the steps again. Great. And I'm so spiritual. What am I doing that for? So we get out of that deal and I end another relationship after inventory. And, where I come from, you can always tell an alcoholic's on a second date because he's driving a U-Haul, right? And most of my relationships end, somebody's moving their stuff, right? Because you just can't have a clean break. You got to move out, right? Because like, "Ooh, well, this is great. Let's live together. It'll be fun," And, God. If I had a dollar, no. So here I am going through the steps again, and my sponsor tells me, he says, "You know what your problem is that you need to get naked with women." And I'm like, "No, that's what my problem is, dude. Haven't you listened to my inventory?" And he says, "No, I'm talking about intimacy. I'm talking about the real deal." And I'm like, "Whoa, I'm not doing that." He says, "What you need to do is you need to be friends with women. Not a friend that wants to be more, right? The buddy, right? That's me. I'm your buddy, So, no, you don't get to do that. You need to be a real friend. And I'm sorry, ladies, I had to start with an ugly one. I did. I had to. I just started to ease my way up into being friends with pretty girls. I really did. I swear to God. But I did, right? And I'm going to tell you, I had an amazing experience. These two gals were talking at a group one night, and the one was having a baby shower, and she said to the other, she said, are you coming to the baby shower?" She says, "I don't know." She looks at me, and she says, "Are you going to be there?" And I went, "No." And the other girl goes, "Oh, no, honey, it's for girls only. I know we think of Chad as just one of us." Right? How amazing is that, right? I did it, right? I'm friends. Right? So my friend Darlene and I become really good friends, and her and I started this weird thing. If you want to do it, it's a lot of fun. Don't rely on it. But what we did was we did a nightly review together over the phone. She would call me, I would call her. And we would do the nightly review upon awakening, when we retire at night, we constructively review our day. And we'd go through that together every night. And then she got sick. And Darlene had this amazing knack for working with heroin addicts, man. She would bring them into her house, put them on her couch, make them chicken soup. And at one point, she had like four of them going. She had one guy with about 5 days, one guy with an hour, one guy with 3 days. And then she'd enlist all of us to come over and help and sit with them. And we'd do 12-step calls with drunks. I was the doorman. I didn't let you out. That was my job. That's all I had to do, is just not let you out. And we helped a lot of people get sober in a brief amount of time. Darlene got sick. She was HIV positive, and she ended up developing full-blown AIDS. And so she got too sick to be able to do that with me, so me and Brendan started doing it. And what we found, just to finish that thought, is that we were relying on each other, not God, to do the step. So if Brendan didn't call, I didn't do the 11th step. So I wasn't doing the step. I was relying on him, not God's power, to do the steps. And so what ended up happening is Darlene, all these people that had she had recovered on her couch, started to come over and do her laundry, clean her house, make her dinner. She got to a point where she couldn't be alone, so we had this babysitting regimen where every few hours somebody new would come by and sit with her for a few hours. People read inventory to her. And at one point she ended up going into the hospital, and I showed up there one night, and I watched her in the only way she could make amends to a woman that she had harmed in sobriety. And it's pretty incredible to watch somebody on their deathbed trying, still cleaning the deal up, you know? She was still cleaning it up. And the nurses at one point were like, who are you people? Why are you here? Who is this woman? Why is she here? What is going on? And, you know, the doctors finally called too and were like, who are all these people? And they were just so impressed with Alcoholics Anonymous and the amount of love that we had given this woman. And the reason today is so significant for me is that on Martin Luther King Day, my friend Brendan called me in the morning and told me that Darlene had passed away. And the night before, the family had called me and asked me to come and do 10 and 11 with her. And I got to go into her hospital room and hold her hand. And I got to do nightly review with her. I read a little bit of 164. Did third step prayer. And if Darlene were alive tonight, I would have called her, because this is what we always did. I would have called her and I would have said, hey Darlene, I'm going out to Utah and I'm going to talk tonight. And she'd say, oh, that's good. And then we'd talk a little bit. She taught me a long time ago that when we get ready to do these things, that energy we feel, that's not nervousness. That's excitement. We're excited to talk about what has happened to us and our experience. And so I told a story one time that she overheard, and she used to always say, make sure you tell them about God. Tell them the story about God. And so if Darlene were here tonight, or alive tonight, she would ask me to tell this story. So being that today it marks the 5th anniversary of her death, I'll tell that story. But the amazing thing about her story is that, and we did a funeral for her. I was invited to plan that. And at the end of the little service afterwards, people were kind of picking up chairs and mopping the floor and vacuuming and wiping stuff down. And the minister came over to me. She said, Chad, what are they doing? And I said, they're cleaning up. That's what we do in AA. We clean up. And she goes, well, that's kind of part of the fee you paid to be here, is that we clean up. I'm like, yeah, but that's what they do. That's what we do. We clean up. We put chairs away and we do that. We do that in our lives. We clean up. So this drunk's walking down the road and he runs into God. And I have to give credit to Steve B. He's the one that told me this story. And I think it's a great story. It's a great example of what happens to us in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the drunk sees God, and God has something. He says, what you got? And God says, it's sobriety. And the drunk says, what's it cost? Because we don't understand that this could be free, right? There's got to be an attachment to it. There's got to be a value to it. I got to pay something for this. And God says, how much money you got? He says, $50. He says, well, today sobriety will cost you $50. And the drunk says, whoa, wait a minute. How am I going to put gas in my car? And God says, oh, you have a car? Well, today sobriety is going to cost you your car. And the drunk says, how am I going to get to work? God says, oh, you have a job? Today sobriety will cost you your job. The drunk says,
How am I going to pay for my house?
He says, oh, you have a house? Oh, well, today's sobriety is going to cost you your house. And the drunk says, well, what about my family? Where are my family? He says, oh, you have a family? No. Today's sobriety will cost you your family. And, you know, being at that magic moment where we are, where you just go, you know what, I'm willing to do anything. I give it to you all. You can have it all. I always talk about, you know, it's a big, Texas Hold'em craze right now still. So it's like, I'm all in. I'm all in, God. You can have it all. You can have it all. I'm in a place in my life where me and my wife have made some really dumb decisions. And so I'm at that point, God, you can have it all. You can have the house, the car, the whole deal. I give it all to you. And so he does that. And God says, here's your house back. It's not your house, it's my house. Here's your family back. It's not your family, it's my family, and you'll take care of them for me. Here's your car back. It's not your car, it's my car. Here's your job back. It's not your job, it's my job. Here's your money back. It's not your money, it's my money. That puts a little spin on Best Buy, doesn't it? Right? It's my money. He says, you can have your life back. It's not your life, it's my life, and I want you to live it for me. And I have to tell you guys, thank you so much for my sobriety and for giving me my life back. If you're new here tonight, I hope you find what I have found. And that's not only a new way to live, but really, 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 truly. And the book talks about this design for living that works. I'm going to tell you, I'm living a life today that I didn't even know I wanted. Truly. And I'm so grateful to be here and grateful to have been asked to do this tonight. And again, I thank you for my sobriety.